Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, we'll be talking with Summit County Council Member Glenn Wright, taking a look at some of the items discussed at yesterday's council meeting. Education and Outreach Director for Summit Land Conservancy, Caitlin Willard, will have details on nature bathing as well as their hops hunting, and Youth Sports Alliance Development Director Jana Dalton with an update on the youth sports organization. Stay tuned. The Park City Mountain Base area development was on the Planning Commission agenda once again, with planners considering a request to approve the project under a 22-year-old master plan development agreement. The public and Park City planners toured the area yesterday afternoon. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
The Park City Mountain Base development was granted approval in 1998. 22 years down the road, present owner Vail is disentangling from the development. They plan to sell the 10 acres of parking lot to Peg Companies, a real estate developer in Provo. About 80 people joined the base area tours. Balloons, cones, ballasts, and paint helped to provide visual renderings of the four phases of the development. Parking plans were clarified by PEG President Robert Schmidt. He said the original MPD allowed for about 1,800 parking stalls, but that has been revised down to 1,200, with about half designed to go underground. They anticipate charging $20 to $25 for day skier parking.
So PEG Development is in a purchase and sale agreement with Vail, meaning that we will purchase the base area and develop it. We're responsible. Part of our agreement in that purchase sale is that we will build the 1,200 stalls. We will own those stalls, but we will hire Vail to act as our manager. So they'll manage the day-to-day operations of those parking stalls. However, you know, they will be responsible to us as the owners of those stalls.
Lowell Avenue resident Nancy Lisenby said she is concerned about the changes from the original 1998 plan and is hoping Park City will require the developer to get a new MPD.
If you look back at the 1998 plan that was approved, all of the parking was underground. So what they're proposing now is four stories of parking structure and then four stories of condos and affordable housing on top of four stories of parking structure. So it makes it an eight-story parking and condo structure if they put the parking underground like had been originally approved by the city in 1998. Then you got normal sized buildings that would fit in with the community.
The traffic circulation plans show two lanes of one-way directional traffic circumventing the entire development. Schmidt said the traffic circulation plan has been submitted to the city.
We're confident that this is a very safe plan. First, we remove a lot of conflict points where we have, you know, left-turning movements and right-turning movements and through movements of vehicles. In creating one-way circulation loops, we create greater gaps in traffic. You know, we feel like providing safe crossings at grade with, you know, a much safer traffic plan than exists today is the right solution for this project.
Enhancements to the existing transit stop at the base of Park City Mountain are included in PEG's proposal, but they have no plans to build a transit center.
Neither the city, nor us, nor Vail owns or controls that land. Now, there is an easement over it, so that the city can use it as a transit center. But it involves, you know, property owners at the lodges and the condos there right around the transit center. And so we have entered into some dialogue with those folks, and I would say it's been positive thus far. There are improvements that the city desires. I suppose it's up to the city to come back to us with a proposal. We haven't received that yet. That very likely could be part of the discussion that we have going forward.
Schmidt said Vail is aware of their plans. They have reviewed them and understand their proposal, and he said they're in general agreement. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
8:13, good morning. Well, the Summit County Council took a site visit to the Silver Lake Village and then met electronically for more business yesterday. On the phone with a recap of the meeting, Summit County Council Member Glenn Wright. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Leslie.
First off, the council approved some staff changes in emergency areas in a year that seems to be a nonstop emergency. It sounds like you're separating two full-time positions in the health department. You're setting up a full-time equivalent position called a public health emergency plan coordinator. Why do you need this in order to get some outside funding?
That's correct. Well, the what they call the PHEP, the PHEP, Public Health Emergency Program Coordinator, is actually funded by state health department grants. And they've pretty much demanded of us that be a full-time position in order for us to get those grants. What we've also found during this COVID emergency and is, you know, that we need a separate emergency coordinator for non-health purposes. Lieutenant Sitaway from the Sheriff's Department has been temporarily filling in with that position, but he's also responsible for search and rescue and has other duties with the Sheriff's Department. In our discussions, we also found that there's a lot of unmet needs for general emergency preparedness within the county. So, you know, we're going to establish this additional position as a emergency coordinator for non-health emergencies.
So that's a part-time position then?
Initially, it will be a part-time position, yes. Initially, a part-time, time-limited position, which doesn't require an addition to the staffing model within the county. We're going to have to see how this develops. I think many of us on the council think there are significant unmet needs there. And as a part-time position, a person's limited to under 30 hours per week on average. If we were to get a major fire in the county, similar to the Rockport fire from several years ago, that person would immediately be working 40 hours or more per week. So we'll just have to see how the emergency season, the fire season in particular, progresses. And, we're going to try to hire this person as soon as possible under a part-time basis and basically see what develops.
Yeah, so under what department is this part-time equivalent emergency planner being put?
It will be within the Sheriff's Department.
Ah, okay. And then what about Chris Crowley? He is the county's current emergency manager. Is he one of these positions?
Yes, and he's the person being moved full-time into the what they call the FEP position. He's been primarily being paid by the grants for that position right now. And obviously, you know, he's done a great job in terms of trying to prepare us for this emergency up front and staying ahead of the emergency as much as possible. I think we're in a much better position than many counties because of his work. So he will pretty much immediately be full-time. Oh, he has been pretty much full-time immediately in that position since the start of the coronavirus pandemic.
All right, and then maybe talk a little bit about what the COVID outbreak has taught the county about emergency staffing.
Can you repeat that, Leslie?
What has the COVID outbreak taught the county about emergency staffing?
Well, I guess in terms of these two positions, it's that we probably were not adequately prepared for it. We didn't have enough staff doing all the things necessary. Of course, the COVID pandemic came up out of, really out of nowhere. It was not something that was particularly anticipated. We've learned from it.
Okay. Anything in particular other than that you maybe have been shorthanded?
I think that is probably the main point that we've been shorthanded on it. I think since the pandemic started, we've reacted pretty well to it. And the reason we've been able to react to it is because of the emergency actions of the Sheriff's Department in backfilling the county's other emergency needs.
All right.
Lieutenant Sitaway has really been a hero in this particular event, and also people that have been assisting him, like Sergeant Wild.
All right. During public comment, the council heard from a school teacher with a unit in Bear Hollow who said that he's had a tough time selling it, and he's asking the county to take it off the deed-restricted housing inventory. Is the problem here some generic problem with deed-restricted housing, or is it this specific unit?
Well, deed-restricted housing is always more difficult to sell. That's a given. And we're going to need, as we pointed out to the person, we're going to need a lot more information from Jeff Jones on the status of our deed restricted housing before we even think about doing anything about this particular issue. I think if you remember in the past, we had a bunch of units over in the Bear Hollow area that the county acquired and resold and will be using the money for affordable housing purposes. I am not predicting that that's what's going to happen here. We need to, we really don't have enough information about this particular unit. Is this a unit that has similar characteristics to the ones that we dealt with in the past?
And what are those? I guess I thought we had a long list of people looking for some affordable housing.
Yes, but the I guess the market is not conducive to those sales right now. People that are looking for affordable housing also may be in tough straits in terms of their employment. I can't predict exactly what the story is on this unit, and that's why we need a lot more information.
All right. Let's see. During the 6 o'clock public hearing, council did not come to a decision about amending the East County Code on livestock fencing. The existing code seems to lean toward the fence out philosophy. That's basically the responsibility to keep animals at least out of the neighbor's yard. But the staff apparently has reported that the provisions are confusing. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. I would agree that the provisions are confusing, and the proposal that was queued up for us was to go to a default of the state fence-in procedures. But in our discussions, we really discovered, I think, that doing that precipitously is going to cause great hardships on a lot of the ranching community. So I think it needs to be studied in more detail. Whether we go to that proposal eventually or we ask for a rewrite of our existing ordinance, that is a decision we still have to make. One of the proposals from one of our commenters, Chris Ure from the Camas Valley, was that maybe we look at creating areas in the Eastern County that are fenced in and some areas that are fenced out. And I think a lot of us thought that that was a pretty good idea. So, I think this proposal needs a significant amount of study before we move forward on it.
Okay. How do you keep track of who's fenced in and fenced out? That seems like a logistical nightmare.
Well, that's going to be part of the discussion. We're going to have to, if we were to go that route, we're going to have to draw some lines on the map. And every time you draw lines on a map, you also get lots of public comment. Which side of the line should my property be on? So it's not going to be an easy decision.
All right. Some further study, it sounds like, then, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Let's talk just basically about the news that you got yesterday about whether or not funding from the CARES Act should be used for Superfund sites. What's your take on that?
We're going to that's also another issue that is going to require significant more study. I think the consensus generally was that the CARES Act money should be devoted primarily to shortages in county operations funds and revitalizing the existing businesses in the community, that new construction on or near Superfund sites are not our highest priority at this particular moment. But we'll have more discussions on it.
Yeah. So what's the issue, though, that the federal government has cut funding then for Superfund sites? So they're saying to tap into.
Apparently there's a proposal floating around out there that would allow CARES money to be used to enhance financing opportunities for construction on or near Superfund sites. And our discussions indicated, oh, that might be a nice thing, but I'm not sure if it's our top priority right now.
Okay. Hey, just wanted to ask you what you have been hearing from residents and businesses about the mandatory mask order.
I think the feedback from the community is mixed. I'd say by far the majority of people are in favor of the mask order and are complying with it. I've been spending the last several Sundays walking on Main Street and talking to shop owners and bar owners there, and I think most of them appreciate the fact that we put this in place because it makes it easier for them to require mask usage inside their establishments. I'm seeing a lot better compliance with masks. I would say compared to 3 weeks ago, if you're walking on Main Street on Sunday, you probably saw 10% of the people wearing masks. Now it's probably 80%, and the rest of them are carrying, because if they're going to go into an establishment, they have to have them. On the other hand, there are people that are upset about it, and unfortunately, you know, we have a vocal minority that thinks we're imposing upon their civil rights. I view it more as a responsibility that people have to try to get us safely through this particular crisis and help both the health and the economy of our community. I think what we're going to need in the future is more help from higher levels of government. I understand the governor is actually somewhat interested in putting on maybe a statewide mask order, but he's received negative feedback from the legislative leaders. I assume that they're going to have to see worse results statewide before they go down that path.
So if you're a betting man, would you think that would happen? Let the governor do that?
I am not a betting man on that particular issue. I am hopeful on that issue. No, I'm not betting on it.
Finally, with regard to transit, as we try to get back to normal, can we tell citizens that it's safe to ride the bus?
It's safe to ride the bus if you're socially distanced and wearing a mask. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Anything else, Glenn, you wanted to mention?
I think that was a good discussion this morning. Any further questions from you?
Nope. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you, Leslie.
That's Summit County Council Member Glenn Wright. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. 8:27. Stay tuned. Coming up, we'll be talking with the Education and Outreach Director for the Summit Land Conservancy, Caitlin Willard. First, Heber City Council rejected one of the properties requesting annexation into the city Tuesday night. KPCW's David Boyle has more about that.
Heber City adopted a new annexation policy plan in September 2018 to reflect potential areas to grow the city. The vast majority of the expansion area is to the north of current city development and almost all entirely on the east side of US 40. The one project to the west of US 40 that has petitioned annexation into the city was the North Village Resort. The North Village Crossing annexation is almost 140 acres located at the southwest and southeast corners of River Road and US 40. The developer signed a 25-year development agreement with Wasatch County in 2013. The plan will result in several hundred nightly rental units and nearly 500,000 square feet of retail, including a gas station and a water park. Councilmember Rachel Kaler brought the developers to the council meeting to address environmental concerns of having a development of that nature so close to the Provo River.
We're not sure we want a water park as the welcome to Heber Valley. We are a beautiful quintessential mountain town. The proposal really is something grandioso, but not necessarily representative of what Heber's always been, and that's this quintessential country town.
Bruce Barrett, the developer of the project, spent some time addressing council concerns regarding the potential environmental impacts of the project. He also spoke about the positive tax revenue benefits of having the commercial base located at the busy intersection. Kaler asked why they wanted to be annexed into the city. Barrett said they are meeting the list of requirements from the county, but they are frustrated by new ordinances regarding required timelines for moving from preliminary plat approval to final plat approval. Councilmember Ryan Stack weighed in, saying he was not interested in moving forward with the annexation.
The density that you want to move forward with here, I simply can't support, especially when I know that it's the subject of a dispute with the county at this time. I don't imagine you have any interest coming back and saying, here's my proposal for my base density I can get with the county today. If you want to do that, I'm all ears. Or if you want to talk about buying up all the development rights in the Northfield that you say you support, I'm all ears as well. But short of that, I simply can't see moving forward with this.
Fellow Councilmember Mike Johnston said he wishes the parcel would stay undeveloped, but felt the idea of the land remaining undeveloped was unrealistic.
It would be a crying shame to have a big resort with a lot of traffic, a lot of intense commercial activity going on, hundreds and hundreds of units being rented on a nightly basis, none of it being in Heber City. We're giving up hundreds of thousands of dollars of sales tax, of property tax, of transient room tax, and a whole lot of impact onto that intersection and onto the highway, which will be in our town. It's going to be there. It's going to be there just like Kimball Junction is sitting there on I-80 and the entrance into Park City. Park City has zero control over any of that. They get lots of impact, zero control, zero money, nothing.
Kaler concluded sharing her dislike of the project.
I don't like the density. I don't like the water park. I don't like that this is the gateway to our community, and I don't think we should be for sale. I don't want to hear that the county is the reason that you don't want to move forward. The county is there because they have put ordinances, they entitled this, and they're expecting developers to meet those agreements. I would rather see a dry 40 acres for the next 100 years.
But that's not what's going to be there.
And that's okay. And I hope that you can go back to the county and resolve your differences and work with the county on making this happen. But I do not want to see this in Heber City. I don't want to see any development west of Highway 40.
With all council members except Johnston on board, the council indicated to Barrett there is no more interest in annexing the project into Heber. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
It's 8:31, 58 degrees here in Old Town Park City. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. On the phone now with an update from the Summit Land Conservancy, I have Outreach and Education Director Caitlin Willer. Good morning, Caitlin.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So let's start with the organization's conservation alerts. Tell us what these are and how people can receive them.
So our conservation alert, for a few years now, the Summit Land Conservancy has been offering this tool that we call a conservation alert, and it helps community members engage in the deciding processes of development projects that can impact our local open spaces and neighborhoods. And because we're not an advocacy organization, we don't necessarily take a stance on these projects, and the alert is unbiased. We do, in the alert, encourage our subscribers to educate themselves and formulate their own opinions, and if they feel the need to, they can speak up. We know that agendas and staff reports tend to be super long and confusing, so what we like to do is we will break down the who, what, where, when, and why, and put that into a concise email so people can kind of just see the point clearly, and then we send that out prior to the meeting.
Okay, and that's just sent out to people who subscribe to newsletters and things like that then?
Yeah, exactly. So people who are subscribed to our general mailing list, but if you do want to go and subscribe to the conservation alert, you can visit wesaveland.org, and you just scroll down to the bottom of the page there, and there's a big stay informed button, and you just click that.
All right, so what projects do you alert about? I mean, I'm guessing not all of them, because there's plenty.
There are a lot. So we generally choose projects that we feel like a lot of people will care about, and we choose projects that we feel will impact general conservation values, like water quality and wildlife habitat, scenic view sheds, recreational values, and things like that.
All right. Summit Land Conservancy also partnering with Communities That Care, offering a new program focusing on the art and healing powers of nature bathing. What's this?
Well, it's not taking a bath, I'll tell you that. So we're super excited to partner with Communities That Care, and they're our local prevention coalition here in Summit County. And we are bringing this program to our community called Nature Bathing. And nature bathing is basically the Japanese form. It's called Shinrin-yoku in Japan, which directly translates to forest bathing or absorbing the forest atmosphere. And it basically just encourages people to simply spend time in nature, like immersed in the sounds and smells and textures and sights of the natural scenery around you. And it really teaches the pleasures of presence in the wild and helps create a more defined sense of purpose in the world.
So what's happening then? I mean, when you talk about a partnership, what does that mean?
So we are going to lead, we're going to lead some hikes every other Monday because we know right now the current climate of the world is definitely a stressful, it's causing a lot of stress and anxiety in our lives. And yes, we know that we're in the middle of a pandemic right now, and maybe it's not the smartest thing to get people together, but people really need nature right now for healing and to find solace. So we are going to get together every other Monday at 6 p.m. and we're going to go for a little hike on an open space protected by the Summit Land Conservancy. And then the wonderful Mary Krista Smith, who is the executive director of Communities That Care, she's going to lead a little bit of a meditation practice while we're out there. And we're just going to kind of help people become more present and, you know, just calm them down. It's gonna be really nice.
Okay, so if people are interested, again, they need to go on the website to sign up?
Yeah, so you go to wesaveland.org, and then we have a sign-up genius, and you kind of sign up for the hike that you want to go on. We're limiting these to only 20 people, and we are requiring masks. But there is no experience necessary to attend. You just need to come with an open mind and a willingness to try something new.
All right. The Hops Hunters program is in full swing. How are the crops looking?
Well, I haven't been on one of those hikes yet, so I don't know what the crops look like. But I'm assuming they're doing well because we have had some rain. But we have hit up a couple of locations already this year. We have been to Empire Canyon, McPullen Farm, and last night we led a hike on our Virginia Mining Claims easement, which is up in Old Town. Those hikes are also limited to 20 participants, and masks are required. What we do have is a couple spaces left in our next two hikes. So we have a hike on July 22nd at the Rail Trail, and then a hike on August 5th at Prospect Ridge. And these hikes, this program's been around for a while, and people really, really enjoy it. So we try to get people to sign up as soon as they can because they will definitely fill up. We do usually kind of have this big hoppy hour celebration at the end of our program where we harvest all these hops and we brew a beer with Wasatch Brewery, but at this point in time, we're kind of really brainstorming what that's going to look like because I don't think we're not going to be trying to get a bunch of people together at this point. So yeah, if you want to sign up for those hikes, you want to go to wesaveland.org. And if you have any questions, you can email Julia at wesaveland.org.
All right. And then the Eat Chocolate and Save Land. Tell us about this campaign.
Okay, well, we are so excited that now you can go and eat chocolate and save land at the same time. We have partnered with Ritual Chocolate, and they have a crowd favorite bar. It's their pine nut chocolate, but what happens is now when you go and buy that bar, 25% of the proceeds will go towards saving the land you love and come back to us. It's the Summit Land Conservancy. The bar it's not like super bitter. It's because it's 55% cacao, and there are pine nuts in it. So when you bite into the bar, it seriously tastes like a bite of open space. So, we think that this bar just really resembles what we do, and it's just a really great partnership that we have going on right now. You can go to Ritual Chocolate Cafe to go pick up one of those.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
Yeah, I do want to mention that all our programs this year are led in Spanish for the first time. We have a really great group of kids, the Bright Futures Conservation Corps, we call them, and they are attending all our hikes and events. So we do have that as a new offering this year, and that's pretty exciting. And then, yeah, as always, you can just go to our website to learn more about what we're doing and check us out on Facebook. We post a lot of fun stuff there as well.
All right. Caitlin Willard is the Education and Outreach Director for Summit Land Conservancy. Thanks for your time this morning. It's 8:40. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, plans to limit full home short-term rentals to Heber's downtown area were scrapped by the City Council on Tuesday. KPCW's David Boyle has more.
Heber City Council has been discussing possible ordinances surrounding nightly rentals like Airbnb and Vrbo in the city for about a year. Council is in agreement that owner-occupied rentals should be allowed in all parts of the city. Complaints regarding full house rentals in residential neighborhoods has led the city to consider limiting full house rentals to a 24-block area near Main Street and Center Street. A Facebook poll conducted by the city on the issue had 285 respondents. The poll showed that 52% of respondents believe rentals should be limited to zoned areas, while 48% believe they should be permitted in all areas. Without a clear directive from citizens, council discussed their options. Councilmember Mike Johnson said he previously supported restricting full home rentals to a zoned area, but has since changed his mind.
I think it's best to permit it in all areas and just do it under licensing. That is what we did with accessory dwelling units. We didn't get bogged down in, well, what neighborhoods would those go in? You just said, this was probably 15 years ago, accessory dwelling units are valid in anybody's house under these conditions, size, parking, safety, and it has worked extremely well.
Councilmember Ryan Stack said he supports the downtown zone requirement.
My concern is with the units that are not owner-occupied. You don't have the same set of incentives in place for somebody to ensure that you have peaceful, quiet, short-term tenants to protect the integrity of the neighborhood. I like what staff has proposed with the draft ordinance to require it in the downtown zone. We've looked at what the property management company that is somewhere here in the county that can respond to concerns.
Council voted to move forward allowing full home rentals within any area of the city, with all members except Stack voting in favor. Council does still plan to implement further regulations on all short-term rentals through a licensing process. Potential regulations include quiet hours, street parking, and use of a property management company for full home rentals. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
8:43 now. Good morning. Well, Park City's Main Street was adorned with four murals over the 4th of July weekend, including one with the words Black Lives Matter. By Wednesday morning, the Black Lives Matter mural had been vandalized. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
Gray paint was used sometime between Tuesday night and Wednesday morning to deface the Black Lives Matter mural on Main Street between the Egyptian Theater and Treasure Mountain Inn. The word black and the clenched fist symbol in lives were both covered up, making the mural read, Lives Matter. A second mural reading Peace, Unity, Love featured a bracelet adorned with the letters BLM. The B was also covered in gray paint. In total, four temporary murals were commissioned over the holiday and were a joint project between the Summit County Arts Council and Park City Municipal. The other murals, which read Solidarity and Justicia para Todos, which is Justice for All in Spanish, were untouched. Park City Mayor Andy Bierman says the project was part of a $15,000 grant to the Summit County Arts Council, which chose Utah-based Black, Indigenous, and People of Color artists for the project. He says the 4th of July weekend was chosen for the project because the traditional fireworks and parade had both been canceled.
We wanted to do something special this year for July 4th because we had canceled the parade and the fireworks. We thought this was the perfect time to highlight our art on the street, and because this community has been in the midst of an equity discussion, we thought it would be very timely to have that art themed on racial equity.
Summit County Arts Council Executive Director Jocelyn Scudder says the murals were chosen as an opportunity for local artists to express themselves with regards to the movements against racial injustice that have been sweeping the nation since early June.
We figured it was a great time to kind of capture this national and international moment while people are talking about race. And also, as Park City has a critical priority of social equity, to really invite some Black, Indigenous, people of color artists to come up and respond with their artistic interpretation to produce a series of these murals that address issues surrounding racial equity and social equity in light of the Black Lives Matter movement and the recent nationwide protests.
Bill Lewis, LJ Fuimano, Mariela Mendoza, and the Roots Art Collective were chosen to create the Main Street murals. The project was already a hot-button issue in Park City before the vandalizations. Many people voiced their support and objections to the project on social media. Some criticized the murals, saying city government should not be endorsing political ideologies. Bierman says the art was not an endorsement of a particular group and instead was intended to spark thought in the community over issues of social equity. Park City has had a community-wide social equity initiative in place since 2018.
I've had people go so far as to accuse us as dividing the community, and that was by no means our intention. And if I think anything, this has maybe uncovered some divides we have and pointed out why we really need to have these equity conversations now. And
Bierman adds the city has already made statements condemning police brutality and expressing solidarity with communities of color, which was also signed by Park City Police Chief Wade Carpenter. Scudder agrees and says the murals were not a statement by local government, but meant to highlight the artists chosen for the project and to amplify their messages as members of the BIPOC community in Utah.
You know, obviously these murals have sparked a really important community dialogue. You know, the art is sharing their experiences, and we are providing a platform. The Arts Council was a coordinator and facilitator in this. We're so grateful for the city's support, but it's about these Utah-based artists looking inward at our own communities in Utah and how they may feel racial equity, you know, how they interpret it, and how this is their message.
The Park City Police Department is currently investigating the vandalization of the murals on Main Street. Fuimano was the artist who created the Black Lives Matter mural and posted to his Instagram account on Wednesday he is on standby to repaint the street if he is asked to. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
KPCW News Time now, 8:47. Good morning. Joining me now on the phone from Youth Sports Alliance, I have Development Director Jana Dalton. Good morning, Jana.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, let's start with Jan's winter welcome. We've already reported that the Board of Trustees has decided that you won't be holding the event this year. Instead, you're running a Jan's winter welcome fundraising campaign. Tell us how that works.
Absolutely. Yes. Unfortunately, due to the current climate, we are not able to host an in-person gala this October. It would have been our 40th anniversary. However, we are excited that we are continuing the legacy of Jan Peterson and Stein Erickson, and we have kicked off a fundraising campaign. This event has, you know, raised well over $400,000 in the past, and with half of that money going back to the seven winter sports clubs in Park City. And we just don't want to give up on the teams this year. We want to continue what we've done in the past and be there to support these athletes and the youth in our community. So, like I said, we have kicked off a $400,000 fundraising campaign, and it's pretty simple. We're just asking the community to step up and support us as they have in the past, and match what they've done in the past, whether you were attending Jan's Winter Welcome last year or 10 years ago or 15 years ago. We just hope that the community will be there and help to continue to support these athletes and the youth.
That's an ambitious goal, $400,000. It sounds like, though, you're off to a good start.
Yes, it's very ambitious, but we're confident that we can do it. We've already raised about $136,000, so we are well on our way. Everybody has been incredibly supportive and just very appreciative of those who are continuing to support Jan's Winter Welcome and the legacy that it has held over the last 40 years.
Right. You've had the opportunity drawing, an opportunity actually to contribute to individual teams. Is that still how it's working if people were to contribute?
Right now we do not have an opportunity drawing in place. However, we are looking at that. We may instigate an opportunity drawing, you know, closer to the event. We're sort of in a wait and hold period, and, you know, given the circumstances, but we think we can pull something off, and maybe, you know, obviously we're not doing a cruise to Italy or Greece this year, but we can do something exciting that's maybe more of a little staycation or something like that. So we are looking at that, and we do want the teams to participate still and give them the opportunity to sell those tickets, because that is money that goes directly to them. So we're hoping to be able to pull that off.
All right. So at this point, though, money that's collected is just going into a general fund and it'll be divvied up accordingly?
Yes. So, again, our goal is $400,000. We will be giving half of what we raise back to the seven winter sports clubs, a quarter to our Stein Erickson Opportunity Endowment, which is our scholarship program for need-based athletes in the seven winter sports clubs, and then a quarter to our Get Out and Play and Activate after-school programs.
Okay. And so then
sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, some teams probably need more help than others. Is it based on a per capita basis, or how is that figured out?
So what we're doing is we're taking an average over the last 5 years of what we have distributed to the teams. So it's very equitable, and you're right. Some teams definitely rely heavily on Jan's Winter Welcome. For example, the Park City Speed Skating Club, they pay for all of their ice training with money raised through the event. So Jan's Winter Welcome is really important to some of these smaller clubs. And like I said earlier, we just don't want to give up on these athletes. We want to be there. We want to support them. So, it's really important this year more than ever.
All right. So you're launching some corporate sponsorships for this. Talk to us about how that works.
Absolutely. So in the past, many businesses and corporations in Park City and the surrounding community have supported Jan's Winter Welcome through table sales. And typically they bring customers, employees, friends to sit at their table and have a great party that evening. With that not happening this year, we're still asking our corporate tables and our sponsors to step up and contribute what they've done in the past. What we're offering is we're giving them the opportunity to, with their donation, purchase $100 gift certificates to a business of their choice, a local business that may be struggling a little bit during these times. And in turn, we're going to give those $100 gift certificates as a thank you to $1,000 and above donors. So it's a win-win for three entities, YSA, the corporate sponsor, as well as the business of their choice.
Great. Okay. Let's see. Fall training scholarships. Tell us about that.
Yes, we are opening our scholarship window on August the 1st. This is our Stein Erickson Opportunity Endowment Scholarship for need-based athletes in our seven winter sports clubs. We are hoping to award about $150,000 in funding this fall. Again, the seven winter sports clubs are going to be Figure Skating of Park City, Park City Ice Miners, Park City Ski and Snowboard, Park City Speed Skating, Utah Olympic Skeleton and Bobsled, and Wasatch Freestyle and Wasatch Luge. So we highly encourage those athletes to go to our website at ysaparkcity.org, fill out the application, get their paperwork ready, and submit those applications as soon as possible. We anticipate a much higher need this year, so it's important to get all those documents and paperwork in a timely manner.
Yeah, at this point, we don't even really know what's going to happen with the competition schedule, right?
We don't. Unfortunately, like everything else, we're in a wait-and-hold period. But, these athletes they're working hard. They're digging deep. They're continuing to pursue their dreams. So we want to be there and with the hope that competitions will go off this winter.
Okay. And how is the, you've got like a $2 plus million endowment for this Stein Erickson endowment. How is that doing?
We do. And thankfully, we have some incredible board members who have invested the money very, very wisely and conservatively. And so our endowment is struggling the storm and doing very well. So we're not having to draw from that to give out funding this fall. And we're very grateful and thankful for our board members and our investment committee who have invested wisely for us. So we're doing okay in that department.
Okay. Jan, anything else you want to mention?
That's it, Leslie. I want to thank the community, and I hope everybody can be there to support us this year. Again, you can go to our website at ysaparkcity.org to make a donation to Jan's Winter Welcome campaign, and we appreciate everybody's support.
All right. Jana Dalton is the Development Director with Youth Sports Alliance. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
8:56 now. Good morning. Well, 3 years ago, Park City announced the purchase of a 5-acre parcel there at the corner of Kearns Boulevard and Bonanza Drive, on which it plans to redevelop into an arts and culture district. After today's Park City Council meeting, that project may finally be getting some traction. Deputy City Manager David Everett is overseeing the project. He's looking for council direction at today's meeting about how to proceed. With the financial impacts of the COVID-19 crisis unknown, Park City is forging ahead with the district as the new center of creativity. Even though the funding source for the project, the 1% Municipal Transient Room Tax, or TRT as it's known, paid for by overnight guests, has been impacted, the city, says Everett, still sees a number of opportunities.
I've been in this business quite a while, and I've seen this, you know, for lack of a better term, the stimulative effect of doing these kinds of projects when the economy's in a really dark place. And I think that it's sort of ironically fortuitous timing in a way that we have an opportunity to really create jobs and bring people in to do the kind of construction work that this project would require at this time.
The city's partners in the project are the Kimball Arts Center and Sundance Institute. Both nonprofits are expected to purchase property from the city here on which they will build their new headquarters. Both organizations have recently laid off staff members as they deal with the impacts of the coronavirus. Everett says they still have some time to get their plans and funding together, as a lot of the infrastructure work has to be completed by the city first.
The city is still very enthusiastic about being partners with them moving forward, but we totally understand that they face different realities as nonprofit organizations. Timing is flexible in terms of the other organizations that would come on, and we're moving ahead with the city's portion of the project with that flexibility really baked into our plan, because a lot of the construction work, honestly, that needs to be done to get the district going, no matter when the partners came on, has to happen ahead of their construction regardless.
The funding for the development, again coming from the municipal TRT, has been hard hit by the pandemic.
The conservative approach has been to not expect TRT revenues to return to pre-COVID levels until approximately fiscal year 25. Hopefully it'll come back sooner, but if not, you know, we're projecting that, and that with the way that budget works, with the way those cash flow works, we still are able to make the project pencil.
The $70 million project does not include moving the substation or power lines nearby. The power lines, he says, have to be moved. This is a future discussion. It's related, but certainly separate. Today's meeting, he says, will focus on the city's portion of the redevelopment.
The majority of the site is going to be a city-owned and managed property, which includes, as you know, significant affordable housing component and two levels of parking underground and a major transit transfer point for the region. So that also includes a really, I think, expansive and inclusive plaza area on the surface that really goes the length of the property there from Munchkin all the way down to almost to the point there at Kearns and Bonanza.
That's David Everett, Deputy City Manager. Right now, the plans contemplate 40 affordable housing units, 250 to 300 underground parking spots, as well as a major transit hub. The Park City Council meets today, starting with this discussion at 4:30 via Zoom. You can find that link to it on our website, kpcw.org. Well, Guardsman's Pass will be closed to traffic starting today for repaving of Big Cottonwood Canyon. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
The construction is part of a larger UDOT project to repave 9 miles of SR-190 in Big Cottonwood Canyon. The project began in early July and is scheduled to continue into the fall. Guardsman Pass from the SR-190 entrance in Big Cottonwood to the Winter Gate will be closed on Thursday, July 9th, Monday, July 13th, and Tuesday, July 14th. UDOT Public Information Officer John Gleason says the closures are necessary for safety during the repaving because the pass is too narrow for construction machinery and traffic to share the work zone. Traffic from Summit and Wasatch County via Empire Pass and Pine Canyon Drive will not be able to link up with SR-190 in Big Cottonwood Canyon during the construction days. Guardsman Pass will be open to traffic from Friday, July 10th to Sunday, July 12th. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
We're We're up to 60 degrees here. Again, looking for a high today of about 84 under mostly sunny skies. Stay tuned now for headline news from National Public Radio, followed by Cool Science Radio. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. It's 9 o'clock.